This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Certainly a 6-3 supermajority of the court is really out of control. An unobstructed opening for owners of property.
Professor Robert Ovetz discusses the implications of some recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions for the working class.
If you went to a funeral every single day, it would take you 600 years to attend all the funerals of the people who will die from the ravages of policy, violence, poverty, and low wages in America in just 1 year.
Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign makes a call for a national moral revival.
I believe the First Amendment and the Espionage Act are in contradiction with each other, but I accept that it would be difficult to win such a case given all the circumstances.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is free after having pled guilty to what amounts to journalism.
We are here in Buenos Aires. We express our full solidarity to the comrades who are under attack, the comrades who are right now kept in prison here in Argentina for the struggles that they made.
Argentinian piqueteros demand the release of their movement's leaders arrested by the government of Javier Milei. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. In the last few weeks, the U.S. Supreme Court has made several rulings that, according to some, favor owners of property and represent a real threat to the constitutional rights of the working class. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer interviewed Professor Robert Ovetz, author of We the Elites, Why the U.S. Constitution Serves the Few, Workers' Inquiry and Global Class Struggle, and When Workers Shot Back, Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921.
We certainly have a Supreme Court that has gone even further than the Rehnquist Court or the Berger Courts before them in eviscerating what limited reforms have led to over several centuries of different struggles by mass movements, disruptive strikes, and so forth. And they are now moving towards essentially eliminating what little accountability exists in the Constitution for concentrated power of property. And we've seen this particularly in the last couple of years with the Jackson ruling on reproductive rights. We've seen it in a couple of cases which were actually joined by one or two of the Democratic appointees that have attempted to eviscerate workers' right to strike. And that was last session. And then in this session, there was another ruling over whether or not the National Labor Relations Board could seek an injunction when an employer retaliates for union organizing. And this is looking increasingly like a bipartisan assault on some of these rights, but certainly a 6-3 supermajority of the court is really out of control. And, you know, we can talk about these decisions that came down last week, but it's certainly out of control in carving an opening, an unobstructed opening for owners of property. And one of the things that a lot of people just don't realize about the Constitution, and you were referencing this, is that property is protected all through the Constitution. And they use what George Carlin called weasel words to avoid using the word slave or slavery. And all through the Constitution, over 20 times, there are protections for slaves and slavery, owning slaves, owning human beings and exploiting them and dominating them. But since slavery was taken out of the Constitution, except for prisoners in the 13th Amendment, those protections for property still exist. And we have a court right now that is going out of its way to even further expand those rights for property.
Well, one of the issues that labor is facing as far as an environmentalist is the Chevron decision, which says that the government agencies can no longer be given deference as to how a bill should be implemented, and it will be up to judges in labor, NLRB, at the Environmental Protection Agency and government agencies. What do you think this is going to mean for the working class and the ability of workers and community people, environmentalists, to protect their conditions and their environment?
This is actually a case that came down in the last week or so that actually overturned that longstanding precedent called the Chevron Doctrine. And the Chevron Doctrine essentially established what had really been an ordinary separation of powers issue in the constitutional system until that point, but it enshrined it in longstanding precedent. And that is that when Congress hasn't specified for any other reason, the executive branch has the ability to make what's called administrative law. And administrative law is made by that part of our court system that a lot of people are not that familiar with. So we tend to focus on what are called the Article III courts, where you have civil and criminal cases, and they go through the district, appellate, Supreme Court level. But also in the federal system, the executive branch also makes law that we otherwise call regulations. And those are done by administrative law judges. And what the Chevron Doctrine did was back about 40 years ago, was it said, you know, these administrative law courts can interpret what Congress intended when it passed the law so that they can make regulations. And only under extreme circumstances can you bring a case to challenge that administrative law. For example, if it violates the Constitution or if it's not being executed according to the law, et cetera, et cetera, can you bring suit? So what this case decided last week was that the Chevron decision doesn't apply anymore because the courts shall always have the ability to be the final adjudicator of what Congress meant. And this puts the courts in an incredibly powerful position of interpreting what the law means. And it has good and bad consequences. For example, it will eviscerate the ability, for example, the National Labor Relations Board to be able to go into a case and then make a determination, for example, whether or not there was an unfair labor practice committed by an employer. It looks like this is no longer going to be possible because in every case, they're going to have to go to a federal court and say, we think that there was an unfair labor practice issued, conducted by an employer, and we want to issue an injunction. And so every time, and the National Labor Relations Board doesn't seek injunctions very often. That was another case that was decided a few weeks ago, that every time it wants to do that, it's now liable to have to go to a federal court. So the flip side to that, of course, is that we no longer have these even less accountable administrative law courts making determinations. And then we have to go to federal court to sue. But it's just going to put another roadblock and impediment in the way of getting action by the executive branch. Now, I'm not as cynical about this as you might be hearing some people talking about this Supreme Court case, because when it comes to some types of regulations, it can actually take years, sometimes more than a decade, before an administrative law court actually issues some determination on whether or not a regulation has been violated. And also those executive branch agencies can also take a very long time to come up with the regulations. For example, we still don't even have concrete emissions restrictions on coal burning power plants and gas burning electrical plants. And that is something that was started back 20 years ago. So this case could have different kinds of outcomes depending on which side of the issue you're on.
Well, one of the promises that Trump has made is that he's going to bring in thousands of people, fascist people, Turning Point USA, to administrate this state. And agencies like the NLRB and other agencies are basically going to be controlled by people who want to destroy them and open union busters and to shut down any action by the NLRB. What does that mean? And the fact that the NLRB was set up after the 30s, after mass mobilizations, general strikes, it was out of the general strikes in Toledo, in San Francisco, in Minneapolis, and other strikes that the NLRB apparatus was set up by Franklin Roosevelt to ameliorate and to deal with workers' movements. If there's the destruction of the NLRB, which is quite possible if Trump is elected, what is that going to mean for the working class?
Well, I'm quite cynical about the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act. I think that labor law is actually an impediment to our ability to organize. Nevertheless, there are times when the National Labor Relations Act can be used to our advantage. So in the cases of unfair labor practices, also in getting official recognition that forces an employer to actually meet and negotiate. However, we know that the outcome of that is that they don't actually have to come to an agreement. And there are many instances of interfering with the ability of us to organize and delaying the process so that it never comes to a vote or we never are able to actually negotiate a first contract. So there's a lot of problems with the National Labor Relations Act. However, those problems that we face, those are beyond the pale for the ruling elite who don't want to have any sort of labor law at all. And I think that if they get what they really want, they're going to see a return to that period that I wrote about in my first book, When Workers Shot Back, when there was no national federal labor law. There were a few states that had some. There were some arbitration schemes like during World War I. And it was a really brutal class war when employers tried to hire thugs and literally shoot at and kill workers that were trying to organize. And workers organized in self-defense and fought back. The two big General Railroad strikes of the end of the 19th century are examples of that, and many other examples prior to the passage of the NLRA.
That was San Jose State University professor Robert Ovetz speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. Thursday, July 5th, was the 90th anniversary of Bloody Thursday. On this date in 1934, police killed two longshoremen, Nicholas Bourdois and Howard Sperry, at a massive dock worker strike in San Francisco. The tragic events of Bloody Thursday turned public opinion against the shipping companies and led the citizens of the San Francisco Bay Area to go on a general strike in support of the dock workers. On the anniversary, New Yorker Chris Silvera, Secretary Treasurer of Teamsters Local 808, talked about the lessons and the fight the working people face today.
1934 was a hell of a year. Some would call it a very good year. Good morning, brothers and sisters of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 10. I bring solidarity greetings from Teamsters Local 808 in New York City. In addition, I want to express worker-to-worker solidarity. In times of open warfare between capitalism, the boss, and labor, we must resort to the battlefront of the picket line. Teamsters will always stand firmly in solidarity with the ILWU. We stand firmly in a legacy of solidarity between our two unions. We must never forget the battles that brought us here, the sacrifices of life, blood, and the tears of families that carried the burden of loss of members in the ongoing struggle of labor to defeat capital. Why was the year 1934 so significant in the war against the capitalist ruling class? You must first go back to the Gilded Age, the Roaring Twenties. During that period, America experienced a surging economy, highly concentrated wealth at the top of the class division, causing massive wealth inequalities between the 0.1%, also identified as the ruling class, Jeff Bezos today, then it was Rockefeller and others of that ilk, and the working class. Consumption became the order of the day. For the first time in America, more people lived in cities than lived on farms. The 20s brought us the Harlem Renaissance, jazz, big band clubs up in Harlem, mixing of races, the introduction of the consumer culture, then prohibition, and ending with the massive crash of October 29, 1929. The Great Depression lasted for almost 12 years. 25% of all jobs were wiped out. President Herbert Hoover acknowledged the crazy and dangerous actions of Wall Street again. With that beginning, he believed that the federal government was not the solution to the problems facing the country. Working families lost their savings and as a result, their homes, Shanty towns grew and became nicknamed Hoovervilles. Now we call them tent cities, we call them homeless people, but we live in the richest country, we could do better. 1934. Workers are now 4 years into this depression. They're feeling the extreme brunt of this economic decline. Pain everywhere, New York, San Francisco, Miami, Alabama, pick a spot, nothing but hell. Today, workers are threatened by greed, technology, and even more greed. Our economic well-being in the workplace and in retirement are threatened as never before. The advancement of artificial intelligence and robotics are being developed to threaten workers across the spectrum of work. We must reach back and call upon our ancestors in the workplace and imbue the militancy of 1934 to protect our future and the future of our children and our grandchildren. This is a moment in time, sisters and brothers. May 9, 1934, West Coast longshoremen went on strike, shutting down ports from Seattle, Tacoma, Portland, San Francisco, San Pedro, and San Diego. Issues included wages, working conditions. The workers wanted $1 an hour, 6-hour workday, and a 30-hour work week. Do you know how revolutionary that was in 1934? Yeah, winding up? Equally important, we wanted to end the shape-up system and create a union hiring hall. The Embarcadero had become known as a slave market. The strike lasted 84 days. By May 13th, Teamsters refused to handle any work on the docks in San Francisco, Oakland, Seattle, and L.A. May 13th saw sailors, firemen, cooks, stewards, masters, and mates, and pilots all joining the strike. On May 15th, not one ship moved. International commerce on the West Coast was shut down. The employer group called the Industrial Association of San Francisco and other employer groups in the Pacific Northwest and L.A. joined in a plan to break the strike by force. Needless to say, that one failed. Two workers died that day. But in between, you got this guy, Frank Ryan. Frank Ryan was known as Joe Ryan, excuse me, known as King Ryan. Comes out here, negotiates this wimpy contract. It gets shut down. Hell bells break loose. And people went back on the picket line. Needless to say that two people died in that struggle right here on the corner, shot down by the police. One was Howard Sperry, say his name.
Howard Sperry.
Nicholas Bordois, say his name.
Nicholas Bordois.
So let's get to Minneapolis. So in Minneapolis, the Teamsters now have their moment in 1934. The coal drivers were organized under the leadership of Vincent Dunn, Carl Skoglund, into Teamsters Local 574. When the coal operators refused to recognize the union, they went on strike, February 7, 1934. The strike lasted 3 days when the bosses agreed to negotiate wages and working conditions. Following that win, the union went on to target the market district, which dealt in perishable goods. They targeted 11 companies demanding a closed shop, $27.50 per week. Excuse me, an overtime pay. The companies formed the Citizens Alliance, representing 166 companies. The companies refused to negotiate. My point, sisters and brothers, since I'm on borrowed time, is that that militancy built what was then became known as the National Master Freight Agreement. It led to the UPS National Contract. It tells you that these national contracts are important in creating solidarity and creating level working conditions across each state. We're going through some tough times. Those of you who like the left or like the right, one old man versus another old man, remember one thing. It's this union
that's
going to deliver you.
Yes.
Not Biden, not Trump, this union.
Yes.
You got to be in solidarity with your union. You got to get up, walk the picket line, stand up and support unemployed workers. Fight for a living wage, not a minimum wage, but a living wage. We need to have more, and I don't give a good goddamn when you have $200 billion.
Yes.
$1 billion is $1,000 million.
Yes.
He has 200,000 years of $1 million. No one needs that much money. That money is the money that was stolen from the working class, stolen from the workers at Amazon, stolen from the workers in Starbucks, stolen from workers all across this country. And we need to mobilize, energize, and not push back, but kick back, fight back. We need a workers' party. We will never be delivered by the Democrats. We will never be delivered by the Republicans. We will only be delivered by each other. Thank you very much.
That was New York Teamster 808 Secretary Treasurer Chris Silvera speaking at the commemoration of Bloody Thursday in San Francisco.
As I went walking one day down in Frisco, as I went walking in Frisco one day, I spied a longshoreman all dressed in white linen, dressed in white linen and cold as the clay. I see by your outfit that you are a worker, these words he did say as I slowly walked by. Sit down beside me and hear my sad story, for I'm shot in the breast and I know I must die. It was down on the front where I worked on the cargoes, worked on the cargoes 10 hours a day. I lost my right fingers because of the speed up that killed many a man in my day. With too much of a sling load on old rusty cable, the boss saved $10, $10 I say. That old rusty sling broke and fell on my buddy. 10 lousy bucks carried Jimmy away.
That was the Ballad of Bloody Thursday by John Greenway. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. In 1968, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and many others called for a revolution of values in America. They sought to build a broad fusion movement that could unite poor and impacted communities across the country. Their name was a direct cry from the underside of history, the Poor People's Campaign. Today, the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, has picked up their unfinished work. Here are Reverend Dr. William Barber and others calling for support for the Poor People's March on June 29, 2024 in Washington, D.C.
When COVID happened, poor people were dying at a rate already of 800 people a day. Before COVID, if you went to a funeral every single day, it would take you 600 years to attend all the funerals of the people who will die from the ravages of policy, violence, poverty, and low wages in America in just 1 year. It would take you 2 years and 19 days to go to all of the funerals of the people that will die today, and oftentimes, silence. Nobody talks about this political genocide, but we are determined today to remember their death and be a resurrection of voting power and voice power like never before.
Economic justice and saving this democracy are deeply connected. We, as a nation, must listen to the demands of the poor, who are pushing and will continue to push political candidates and elected leaders to lift from the bottom so that everybody can rise.
We are the poor, the marginalized, and the underpaid. And we are taking one step forward to say that everybody has a right to live.
Poverty is not the fault of those who are impoverished. It is caused by those who make the policy.
There are over 135 million poor and low-wage, low-income people in this nation.
The biggest block of potential voters by far is low-income, low-wage voters.
I can't afford medicine. Sometimes I have to skip because of the cost.
The farmworker community is tired of the violence imposed upon us by greed, exclusion, and denial of basic human rights.
Those folk that represented by that casket, poor and low-wage workers who are the most moral people in this country because they go to work every day believing, even though going to work is hazardous to their health.
I'm tired of working 70 to 80 hours a week and still not have money for the necessity of bills. I'm tired of getting sick and not being able to go see the doctor. having to make a choice to pay between rent or the light bill or food or clothes.
You cannot claim to care about families and a culture of life and then do everything in your power to rob people of equal access to resources and to force them to live in poverty.
Leadership of both parties that waged war on poor people and low-wage workers.
And this government has treated people experiencing poverty, including their military families, with disdainful, deliberate, malicious neglect.
So the truth is that my son died from poverty.
We refuse to accept poverty as the fourth leading cause of death.
The fourth leading cause of death in this, the richest country in the world.
We march today for our children and the generations to come.
And we need to do it with the loudest voices possible, the biggest actions possible.
We will voice our demands and register our vote.
When we stand up, and when we stand together, things change. That's right.
There is the electorate that is, and then there is the electorate that should be.
34 million eligible poor and low-income voters did not vote in 2016. If just 20% of those voters in swing states were mobilized around an agenda, they could change the political outcome of every election. So we're launching the most massive voter mobilization and turnout campaign in history of poor and low-wage voters, allies, and religious leaders.
People are dying, but we know it doesn't have to be this way. And so we are calling on everyone to join us in this Poor People's Campaign, a national call for more revival.
We are here, we will be seen, we will be heard, and our power will be felt. We don't need to be an insurrection. We are a resurrection that will be felt across this country. Are you ready? 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 We are a resurrection, and we are ready.
And we won't be silent anymore.
There are 140 million poor and low-income people in the United States today. Learn more about the Poor People's Campaign at www.poorpeoplescampaign.org. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Thomas O'Rourke. Julian Assange became a free man on Wednesday, June 26th, after leaving a U.S. federal courthouse in Saipan, Northern Marianas, a U.S. territory, following a plea bargain hearing in which he essentially pled guilty to journalism. When asked by the judge what crime he committed, Assange replied,
"Working as a journalist, I encouraged my source to provide information that was said to be classified in order to publish that information. I believe that the First Amendment protected that activity, but I accept that, as written, it's a violation of the Espionage Act statute."
So you had certain belief, but you understand what the law actually says as well.
I believe the First Amendment and the Espionage Act in contradiction with each other, but I accept that it would be difficult to win such a case in given all the circumstances.
Assange's extradition to the U.S. to face multiple counts of Espionage Act and computer hacking felonies appear to be collapsing under the weight of its own legal and moral contradictions, according to both a Washington Post article from June 28th and the panel discussion that follows. What follows are excerpts from a discussion between a group of veterans of the Assange story, including, in order, British journalist Richard Medhurst, Mohamed El-Masi of Defense Truth, Joe Loria of Consortium News, and Kevin Gostola of The Dissenter, and Independent.
Hello, everyone. Journalist. My name is Richard Medhurst. Thank you for joining a special panel today. All the participants in this event are colleagues of mine. They're journalists who have covered the Julian Assange extradition case and this saga for years alongside me inside the court. They were with me in the trenches, so to speak, and they've been there the entire duration, either virtually or in person or both. And remarkably, this is almost all of the journalists who have done this in total, which is, you know, a shocking number. Among those journalists who are missing from today's panel are Stefania Morizzi, Dustin Hoffman, Craig Murray, Chris Hedges, Moritz Müller. But nevertheless, the number itself goes to show you how mainstream media completely abdicated their duty to uphold freedom of the press. But I'm very happy that all of you have taken the time to come here and have this conversation about the Assange case, about the mainstream media's role and how it came, how this plea deal came about, and anything else you want to touch on. So what was your reaction when you saw Julian get free, and what was your reaction to the plea deal?
On the one hand, it's amazing. On the other hand, I do wish, I like, this has got nothing to do with Julian, obviously, but I do kind of wish we had some form of resolution at the appeal. Because having followed it now for the better part of over 5 years, it does feel like we were robbed of a positive decision.
Yeah.
In the courts, and in fact, I think the evidence is clear that the Americans were rightly afraid that they would lose. The only concern is how long could they have kept it going, including appealing, losing at the appeal. And how much would Julian's health have degraded? That's the real issue there. Because I think, you know, I won't go into it now, but the First Amendment, the possibility, the high likelihood that Julian, or the likelihood that Julian might be prejudiced at trial due to his citizenship or nationality, they had no way of guaranteeing to the High Court that wouldn't be the case, especially since they had already given an affidavit that might be the case. So there is that, basically. There is the sort of, I wish he had been fully cleared, and it's incredibly frustrating that he was essentially coerced into accepting a guilty plea, albeit to a single charge, and contrary to what Matthew Miller, is that his name, Kevin? Is it Matthew Miller, the spokesman?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At one point during his press briefing, he said, during the amazing press briefing where he clearly had a rehearsed statement about all the things WikiLeaks did wrong. And when he was asked questions about it, he's like, well, this was 15 years ago. Like, I don't know the details. I wasn't there. It's like, well, then why did you just give this whole... Anyway.
Mohammed, there was a positive outcome. The positive outcome, yesterday morning, the Eastern District of Virginia dropped the case. It's over. The whole computer hacking thing, gone. They won. Assange won this case. And as far as there is no legal precedent because an appeals court hasn't decided this. There's no real political precedent, in my view, because that was set by Franklin Roosevelt in 1942 when he tried to indict Chicago Tribune reporters for reporting that the U.S. had broken the code over the Midway. And the grand jury in that case didn't return an indictment. And then Nixon also tried to indict the New York Times reporters on the Pentagon Papers case. And that had to be, he impaneled a grand jury in Boston, and that had to be dropped because it was learned that about the prosecutorial misconduct, that they had tapped Ellsberg's phone, which meant they also tapped the New York Times reporter's phone. So that was dropped. This was the only time it was successfully done. So they've already tried to use the Espionage Act against reporters. The problem, as Julian's statement in that courtroom in Saipan is that, yes, he broke the law as it's written, but as it's written, it's unconstitutional because, as he said, the First Amendment contradicts it completely. This is the problem with the Espionage Act, and I hope that his case highlights that. Had he gone to Virginia and had they challenged whatever decision is to go to the Supreme Court, that would have been a more dramatic way to do this, but I think his appeal points out that, yes, he did break the law the way it's written. Technically, it says in the Espionage Act that anyone possessing or disseminating it is liable to this. And this is the real problem here. Now, Tlaib, the congresswoman from Michigan, has put forward amendments that would make it only applicable to government employees who have written or signed non-disclosure agreements. But that's not the way it is right now. So this is the real problem. And I don't think, I think it's a great victory for Julian Assange. I think he kicked their butts. And here in Australia, where I am now in Canberra, Albanese is getting killed by the opposition because he was the first one to call him, and he's treating him like a hero. And they're calling him in the Murdoch press here a convicted felon, just like we heard in the debate, right? Convicted felon. Convicted felon. He's a convicted felon. How could he call him? And Penny Wong, the foreign minister here, also said, you know, he better not leak anything because we have laws against that too. She's either stupid or willfully saying those things because she knows that he doesn't leak. He's not the leaker. He's the publisher of leak. So he won. I think it's a great day.
I think Barretta is the one that really screwed us in terms of precedence with her 2021 decision. Because, you know, as you all know, she blocked it on health grounds, but she agreed with the rest.
Yes, except the high court, so magistrates' courts can't bind other like district judges can't bind other district judges if they're both sitting in the magistrates' court, right? You're bound, it's higher courts that have the precedential value. I mean, it can be persuasive. So if a future case, a district judge could look to see what their fellow district judge, you know, Judge Berater decided when she was presiding over Assange's extradition case, but they wouldn't be bound completely by her decision the way it would be by a high court or a court of appeal precedent or Supreme Court precedent. And of course, within extradition cases, now you skip the court of appeal, but the court of appeal can still make decisions. However, you're right, Tariq, that a number of the rulings made in this case by the High Court, such as that the wording of extradition treaties, if the Extradition Act in the UK is silent on extraditing people for political offences, but like 99% of all the treaties the UK signs explicitly prohibits extraditing people for a number of things, and one of them is for political offences. So what they said is, well, okay, it's Parliament's treaty, it's Parliament's Act that matters, not the treaty, and it's silent. So we're going to choose to interpret that silence as overriding the explicit provision that the UK government went through the whole process of negotiating with the United States, presumably with Canada, you know, all the other countries. So they're saying that what this was all just fanfare, that when the UK government is negotiating treaties, that, by the way, if the roles were reversed and you're in the United States and the Brits want you, you have protection of extradition over political offenses because they're not interpreting their laws that way. So, yeah, there are a number of shockingly terrible decisions, particularly from the High Court, because they are a higher court, that have.
He froze.
I disagreed with this idea because I felt like it was giving too much ground to the U.S. government, because it was clear to me that part of what emboldened them to bring this Espionage Act prosecution was because they could say so clearly that Julian Assange was not a journalist. So I didn't think it was good enough for us to continually point out, although it was true, that he engaged in standard news gathering activities, because there was a demonization that had been effective. We know that that's an aspect of every single Espionage Act prosecution, at least going back to, well, you can extend it back to Daniel Ellsberg, because that's the model case that the Justice Department has been running off. But if you really look at those chunks of cases with whistleblowers like John Kiriakou and Thomas Drake and Daniel Hale and other whistleblowers that have been targeted, it's really dependent on tearing the person down so that you can make it easier to bring these cases forward. So I definitely took issue with that. But, you know, you asked earlier, and I figure I'll go ahead and give you my reaction to learning this news, having spent so much time alongside all of you who did a remarkable job doing coverage, that I got a phone call. I don't believe this is private information I need to keep. CIA whistleblower John Kiriakou gave me a phone call and was telling me that this was all over. And he said, "Did you see what happened?" And I'm thinking, did somebody die? Because he was very serious. And I didn't have any idea. I had not been on social media. And then he says, "Yeah, well, you know, Julian Assange just pled guilty. He's out." And so then I hopped on and was doing coverage immediately. But that just shows you how, it was really abrupt, but I encourage anyone who sees this conversation to go read the Access journalism that was published by the Washington Post in the last 24 hours that describes just how miserably this all collapsed for the Justice Department, because we could tell from Julian Assange's legal team, from the statements they were making during the press briefings, that this was working out in their favor, that the Justice Department came to them interested in negotiating. But it's actually even more incredible for Julian Assange's team if you read the Washington Post story. Actually, when I read this Washington Post story, I could only think of another example of access journalism working in our favor, which was the Yahoo News report that revealed key details about Mike Pompeo and the CIA targeting Julian Assange and discussing plans to kidnap or assassinate him. I mean, this is a nice record of how basically they bailed on the Julian Assange case because they knew they were going to lose in the appeals court, and they didn't want to lose in the context of an extradition request, so they decided to end it on their own terms.
Well, not completely. It was Julian's terms too. It was a negotiation.
Yeah. And he got incredibly favorable terms.
But one of the points was, and this is the point that Barry Pollack made during the press conference, it's also in the plea agreement, if he had won at the appeal stage, which I believe that he had a strong case of winning because the Americans had put themselves in a corner, they had previously said, given affidavit saying that there's a real possibility, given various case law, they cited various examples, that Julian, because he's a non-US citizen and a non-US person, he would not be entitled to First Amendment protections, right? And then that then backfired against them when the judges are like, hold on a second, because the defense raised this. You're saying he wouldn't have the same rights to raise First Amendment arguments as a US citizen? That can't be possible, because even in the UK, as draconian as things can be here, we have a Human Rights Act. And so however strong or weak the freedom of speech, freedom of press protections would be here, they pertain to human beings, not citizens or nationals or what have right. you. That's one of the reasons why there's so much of the establishment here, political establishment, don't like the Human Rights Act.
Yeah.
They don't think there should be equal rights for those basic fundamental rights. So there is they back themselves into a corner, and it's very clear, even from the wording of the judgment of the high court judges, that they were increasingly skeptical, right? That at first they're like, oh, just give us some assurances that he'll be treated equally in terms of the First Amendment. And then they couldn't. So, but anyway, Barry Pollack, the point he made was, and that's in the plea agreement as well, that even if he'd won, that would only have related to this case, which related to the publishing activities WikiLeaks engaged in from 2009 to 2011, right? The Iraq war logs, Afghanistan war diaries, Guantanamo Bay detainee files, and the cable gate, diplomatic cables. It would not have, they could have then still sought his extradition, perhaps from somewhere else, right? Based on other publications. So he might have been able to leave the UK, and they could have said, well, what about Vault 7, the CIA cyber warfare tools that he published? We want to go after him for that. So the plea agreement protects him for prosecution for any conduct, publishing activities he's engaged in up to the date of signing of the plea agreement, which was what, yesterday or 2 days ago now, my brain is all the days are merging into each other, right? That's amazing. So actually, that's a very good deal.
That was a portion of an online discussion whose entirety can be found at the Consortium News website entitled Watch, Revisiting the Assange Case, from the June 29th of this year. The producers and reporters of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy from Pacifica Radio wish to extend our heartfelt thanks and relief at the news of the release of WikiLeaks publisher and journalist Julian Assange after years of incarceration, lies, threats, and propaganda. We also thank the global campaign that remained dedicated to keeping this case visible, even when much of the media were ignoring it. That was Argentinian rapper Daniel De Vita, Atrapen a Assange. The mass movement for food and survival in Argentina has been led by organizations called the Piqueteros. They held a rally last week at the courthouse in Buenos Aires, where their leaders had been arrested by Javier Milei's government. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer has this report.
Of English, yeah. And I work with Liana Ajerebuba, right? We're there just to defend, you know, these, the fighters, the strugglers, okay? Because we believe that just the government, you know, is just the one who's doing all this, who's making all this mess, you know? And the thing is that, I mean, just by putting up, you know, the truth, you know, they're just allowing everybody just to think that these people who are real strugglers, you know, I mean, should be in prison just for nothing they've done. I mean, nothing at all. Just the government is the one who's doing that, okay?
So they're fabricating cases.
Yeah.
They're making up cases.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, definitely.
Why do they want to crush the Piqueteros movement?
Because they want to crush us, you know, the workers' movement, you know, and the Piqueteros movement just is one of the main, you know, pillars of our workers' movement, right? Especially, I mean, just the left, you know, I mean, because the left has always been very consequent, you know, the Partido Obrero, all right, has always been very consequent with the struggles, all right, and has always focused not only on this government, but just also on the Kirchnerismo, right, before, the government before, you know, that, I mean, it's just guilty, you know, that we've just are here, okay? I mean, everything wraps up, okay, to make us guilty or something, I mean, we are proud of that. It's just to, you know, to really be with workers and with social movements, right? And, well, that's the truth, you know.
And are you concerned about Milei and he accuses people of being communist? He accuses the Peronists of being communist, like Trump?
We actually laugh, you know, I mean, because that shows that he really does nothing.
But that's what fascists do.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm not going to put that down, definitely not. But the point is that sometimes it's like, the point is that he says that we are communists, which we are, okay? But he also accuses Kirchnerism, you know, to be communist, and that's real laugh, you know? Just Cristina Kirchner said that Milei was talking just about a word that didn't exist because for her, communism has ended. She yells at him, you know. I mean, she's just a very capital leader too, you know. So that Milei, you know, I mean, mixes us up, you know, with Kirchnerism. It's just on purpose, you know.
And what would a socialist solution be for the crisis in Argentina? What was the solution?
Solution, first of all, just to discuss and not to pay the debt, you know. This is just the main thing that we want to do. But the point that we've got another problem here, the unions, you know, the trade unions, you know. The trade unions, I mean, just the heads of the trade unions, you know, are just with the government, with every government, you know. I mean, with every government they've been in Argentina, all the trade unions are the heads, you know.
Do they support capitalism?
Yeah, they do, because they are, I mean, just... They do business, you know, with them, actually.
Soy Ileana Cheloto, secretaria general de la Asociación Gremial Docente, docentes universitarios y preuniversitarios de la Universidad de Buenos Aires.
She's a representative of the professors of the University of Buenos Aires. They are here to support all workers united to fight together against the capitalist system. And they are supporting specifically the Movimiento Piquetero. They are supporting the United Front of workers who are employed and those who are unemployed.
Hello, I'm Fabio from Sicobas Union in Italy. We are here in Buenos Aires. We express our full solidarity to the comrade Chiquito Belliboni, Tango, and other comrades who are under attack, the comrades who are right now kept in prison here in Argentina for the struggles that they made.
What's the connection between Piqueteros movement and what's going on in Italy?
In Italy, as Sicobas workers and as well as unemployed from the Movimento Disoccupati 7 Novembre, as well we are under repression, as well we are under attack, with several accusations of association for criminal activity and whatever, just for the struggles that were brought on as workers, as unemployed, not compromising struggles against this system and to better our conditions. So we are fully full solidarity with Argentinian comrades, as well as with Turkish comrades of the SEP and everyone else who is under attack right now. We will continue to, even from distance, to strengthen our solidarity to the other comrades and to the other workers, and to strengthen our collaboration, cooperation for the international working class.
And Milei has been to Italy. He supports Meloni. What is the role of international fascist movement? What do you see that as a threat?
There is sure there are right governments who are rising, even if Milei is not like Meloni. Repression went on even before, but right now they are new instruments are put in place to attack the working movement, the working class movement. Also in Italy, as well as here, there are new laws who are being discussed to prohibit picket lines in strikes. So it is an ongoing repression. In this case, there is a working class movement in Argentina. In Italy, there are some sectors of the working class who are struggling, but the government is, I would say, preventively putting in place new instruments for repression. So it's an international fight.
And the attack on immigrants in Italy, the attack on immigrants, what's going on with that? Is there a, I mean, Trump says he wants to get rid of 11 million immigrants in the United States.
Italy uses immigrant labor constantly. It couldn't be, it couldn't do anything without it. Immigrant workers are producing, together with Italian workings, the wealth of Italian capitalism, as well as of European capitalism. The aim of these anti-immigrant policies and rhetoric is to keep them divided, keep immigrant workers divided from Italian workers, to keep them subordinated, to avoid this unity of workers that can be very dangerous. We know that where there is much immigration, there always has been a stronger movement and fight by the working class, and this is the thing that they want to prevent with these measures.
And what kind of actions has the CECOBAS done in your organization in Italy? International actions.
We fought since the first day of the war in Ukraine against the genocide in Palestine with several international actions in our strikes, in our demonstrations, but also strengthening ties with other organizations on international level. The 24th of February, there was an International Action Day, which was which had several actions in different places in the world.
Against U.S. military bases. Were you picketing U.S. military?
U.S. and against Italian military bases, because Italy hides its imperialism, but actually it is an imperialist country that profits from the alliance with the from sharing the G7, from being in this group of big powers, and tries to cut their piece of imperialist power.
That was Steve Zeltzer reporting from Buenos Aires, Argentina, about the rally to demand the release of the Piqueteros leaders who've been arrested by the Javier Milei government. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Akua Holt, Thomas O'Rourke, Ann Garrison, and Polina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Thanks for listening.